This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. If you watched Barack Obama's inaugural celebration at the Lincoln Memorial, one of the performers you saw that day, ushering in a new era, was John Mellencamp. He sang his song Pink Houses, the one with the refrain, "Ain't That America for You and Me." Mellencamp has been singing about America for a long time under a variety of names: John Cougar, John Cougar Mellencamp, and now just John Mellencamp. His hits from the 1980s include Jack and Diane and Small Town, and his song This Is Our Country was used in a series of ads by Chevrolet. His songs have been used for political campaigns, too, by Democrats and Republicans. This summer, John Mellencamp is on tour, sharing the stage with Bob Dylan and his band and Willie Nelson. They'll be performing mostly at minor league ballparks. Mellencamp's latest CD is a concert compilation called Life, Death, Live, and Freedom, which features live recordings of songs from his recent album, Life, Death, Love, and Freedom. We'll hear Mellencamp perform some new and old songs today from an interview he recorded with Terry Gross in March. Let's start with the opening track of Life, Death, Love, and Freedom, an album with a lot of songs about mortality. This song is called Longest Days.
Seems like once upon a time ago, I was where I was supposed to be. My vision was true and my heart was too. There was no end to what I could dream. I walked like a hero into the setting sun. Everyone called out my name. Death to me was just a mystery. I was too busy raising a cane. But nothing lasts forever. The best efforts don't always pay. Sometimes you get sick and you don't get better. That's when life is short, even in its longest day.
John Mellencamp, welcome to Fresh Air. I have to say, you know, I just wasn't prepared for this song that opens the new CD. It's just so much about mortality and things that aren't necessarily ever going to get better. When I first started listening to the song, I think I was kind of depressed. It was the middle of winter, and it really spoke to me. Sometimes you really need songs like this, so thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you. The song actually was... That line, my grandmother lived to be 100 years old. And it's a funny, it's not a funny ha-ha story, but this is how the line came about. I used to go see her in the afternoons, and sometimes she'd make me lay in bed with her. You know, I was like 45 years old or something. And my 100-year-old grandmother, she'd call me Buddy, and she'd go, Buddy, come and lay down with me. And I'd go, okay. So I'd lay in bed with her, and we'd talk sometimes, and you know, she was great up until about 99, and then she started getting kind of dementia and stuff like that. And one afternoon, I was laying in bed with her, and she said, let's pray. And I said, okay. And so she starts praying, and she says, God, you know, Buddy and I are ready to come home. And I went, whoa, wait a minute, Grandma, you're ready to come home. Buddy's only 45, he's not ready. And then she turned at me and looked at me right in the face, and her face all of a sudden looked like a little girl. And she goes, Buddy, life is short in its longest days. And I always remembered that line, and I thought, well, surely someday I'll be able to work that line into a song. And that's how that song started.
You know, it's funny that, you know, your grandmother would have said life is short in its longest days, because one of the things I like so much about the song is that hook, and it's so, although this isn't a country song per se, there's so many country songs that have that kind of contradictory language in its title. Like Roger Miller has a song called More and More I Miss You Less and Less. You know, that that kind of like contradiction. And so you just got that from her.
Well, you know, I don't really see it as a contradiction itself. I just think it's a true statement. I mean,
yeah.
I look at my kids and I look at myself and I go, wow, what happened? You know, where did this all go? And of course, my parents were very explicit with me about, you know, John, time goes by real quick, and you know, you better enjoy. Try to enjoy every moment. My dad has been retired from his job since he was 49 years old, and he's 79 now. And every day he says the same thing to me. He says, "Did you do anything fun for yourself today?" And I'll go, "No, Dad, I'm working." He goes, "You gotta do something for yourself, fun every day, because if you don't, then life's gonna be pass you by, and you just, you know, what good is it?"
No, I mean, you're obviously feeling that song that we just heard, Longest Days, but it's also great song craft. At the risk of kind of killing the lyric, let me just like read a few lines. "Nothing lasts forever. Your best efforts don't always pay. Sometimes you get sick and you don't get better. That's why life is short, even in its longest days." Can you talk a little bit about your process of writing a song like this? You were telling us that the main hook, the "Life is Short" line, basically came from your grandmother, but what about the rest of it?
Well, you know, as I've matured as a songwriter, I realize that if it's out there, it's mine. You know, everything I see and hear, I don't care if Shakespeare wrote it, or Tennessee Williams wrote it, or if Bob Dylan wrote it, or I see it on a sitcom. If I hear words, they're mine. And so I will take ideas from any place, anywhere, anytime, and life has become a song to me. I'm always looking for a song. Sometimes, like the Longest Days, I got up one morning and the song came to me in a complete thought. Hmm. All I had to do was get up and write it down. There was no laboring about rhymes or melody or any of that stuff. It just was, there it is. And when that happens, you know, you just kind of got to look up and go, thank you.
Right. Well, my guest is John Mellencamp. John, you're in your studio and you have your guitar with you. So I'm going to ask you if you could sing another song pertaining to mortality from the new CD. And this is called "A Ride Back Home."
Hey, Jesus, can you give me a ride back home? I've been out here in this world too long on my own. I won't bother you no more if you can just get me in the door. Hey, Jesus, can you give me a ride back home? When I started out, I was so young and so strong. I just let it roll off my back when things went wrong. Now it's starting to get to me, oh look, this inhumanity. Hey, Jesus, can you give me a ride back home?
Thank you. And that's John Mellencamp performing a song from his new CD, Life, Death, Love, and Freedom. Do you mind if I ask what kind of religion you were brought up with, like what church was like when you were young?
Well, my grandmother, back to my grandmother, made sure that I went to church every Sunday. And she'd come over and pick us boys up, and we would go to the Nazarene Church. And back then, that was about as close to heaven as I ever got, because just the time to be able to spend with her, and she was very, very religious. But see, you know, I'm in. I don't even worry about it. Because before she died, she said, "Listen, buddy, when you die, I'll be waiting on you, and you're in." So I figure, you know, I don't got nothing. I got nothing to do. She's taking care of it for me. So if there is a heaven, I'm in. So I don't even think about it. Although she did say, "Buddy, you're gonna have to stop that cussing." But other than that, you know, if I can just clean up my language, I'm pretty sure I'm in the Golden Gates. So. I trust her and I believe her, and so, yeah, I grew up Nazarene. That's where I went to church, and then finally, about 17 or 18, I just kind of quit going.
And now?
And now, the church would fall down if I walked in. I'm not a big advocate of organized American religion.
Here's another mortality question, if you don't mind. You know, as I've been saying, there's a bunch of songs on the new CD that are about mortality. You had heart surgery in the 1990s, right?
I had a mild heart attack because I smoke and because I have high cholesterol. And for 10 years before that, the doctors were telling me, John, you need to get on cholesterol medicine. My answer was always the same. Am I all right now? And they go, yeah, you're all right now, but you're heading for disaster. Okay, well, I'll deal with disaster when it gets here. Well, it got here. So I have no one to blame or anything like that about having a heart malfunction. But I did not have open heart surgery or anything like that.
So this was more than 10 years ago.
Actually, it was 1994.
Mm-hmm. So you weren't writing songs like this then, were you?
Yes, I was. I've been writing. See, the problem is that music is so, during the 80s and the 70s, and, you know, the songs and the arrangements of the songs had to be a certain way to get on the radio, and it really screwed up songs. It really messed up. I've been writing about this stuff forever. I've been writing about mortality. I've been writing about... You know, I only write four songs. Come on, I got the same four songs. I just rewrite them, 50 times. But I got four topics that I cover. You know, I cover race, and I cover what you're calling mortality. And then I, sometimes write about girls, but I'm too old to write about that now. So, I only got a few things I write about. But if you listen to songs that I've written, some people ain't no damn good. They, that song is about mortality. When the Walls Come Crumbling Down, it was about the government. So because of the music and the lightness and the arrangements of the music of that time were of a certain ilk and even got worse in the 90s, the songs, to be able to be on the radio, really had to take on a candy-coated appeal. Pink Houses was always anti-Reaganomics. People loved the Ain't That America. So, people take from songs only what they want to hear. And I'm just like everybody else. So you kind of got to lift up the veil of a lot of songwriters' songs to really realize what's being said.
Well, let's take, I think, an excellent example of what you're talking about, which is This Is Our Country. And a lot of people know that song from the Chevrolet Silverado ad. And it sounds like, an American anthem when you just hear...
The chorus.
The chorus. Right. But I'm going to ask you to sing a verse from it that gives a very different impression than what people might have walked away from the ad. And this is... Can you do the verse that goes, and there's room enough here for religion to forgive? And room enough here for science to live?
Well, there's room enough here. Let me see if I can do it. Well, there's room enough here for science. I got a cigarette in my mouth. I take it.
No, take it out.
Hold on. All right, here we go. Well, there's room enough here for science to live. And there's room enough here for religion to forgive. And try to understand all the people of this land. This is our country. Yeah, I think that, simply because it was my one and only television commercial, that outraged a lot of people, and what the song is really about was missed. But, I knew that was going to happen. But I really had no... idea how much that song was going to be played.
This Is Our Country is kind of like a plea to end the culture wars, to be inclusive, to respect each other.
Yes.
Do you feel it became an anthem for something else in the minds of many people?
Oh, I don't care. I mean, it became an anthem for Chevrolet, I think.
Right.
I mean, because that's how they discovered the song, because they couldn't discover the song in the way that they discovered Pink Houses, or the way that they discovered, you know, I need a lover. It's impossible to discover a song that way.
But what went through your mind when Chevrolet asked you to use it? Did you think immediately this would be a good idea? Did you have reservations about it?
Oh, listen, I had spoken out against. I was the same way that you are, and I still don't think that an artist should have to get involved with Wall Street on any level. That's not what I really do. I don't write songs for commercials, but I did this because I thought, well. Perhaps they are right. I had so many people saying, John, you have turned down fortunes and fortunes of money. And now is the time. The music business has changed. Nobody is, your songs can't grow from the ground up anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So go from it from a different angle. So that's what we did.
And what did you learn from the experience?
I learned that an artist shouldn't have to do this. This is not what my songs are about. But I also learned that Chevrolet was a better record company than Columbia.
Because they got your song out there.
Well, because because they also, what they said they were going to do, they did. They kept their word.
Which was?
Well, record companies never keep their word. That's the point of the whole conversation.
Uh-huh, okay.
Record companies say we're going to do this, this, and this, and this, and they never did any of it.
John Mellencamp speaking to Terry Gross in March. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview from March with John Mellencamp. His newest album is called Life, Death, Live, and Freedom, featuring live versions of songs from Life, Death, Love, and Freedom.
Now, I also want to talk with you about Pink Houses, which is the song that John McCain had briefly used in his campaign. And we'll talk about what happened with that. But play the hook from it so everybody knows the song.
Let's see how that goes. Ain't that America? Okay, here we go. Ain't that America for you and me? Ain't that America something to see, babe? Ain't that America, home of the free, yeah. Little pink houses for you and me.
So when you found out John McCain was using it in his campaign, and you are a lifelong Democrat, how did you decide to handle it?
I wouldn't say I'm a lifelong Democrat. I'm very liberal.
Okay, right. You can vote whatever you want, but you're very liberal.
I'm very liberal.
Got it.
Yes, I'm very liberal. Well, what happened was is that I called up my publicity guy, a guy named Bob Merlis. I said, Bob said, you know, McCain's using your song. And I said, well, he can use it if he wants to, but you probably ought to write him a letter and say, you know, not only, you know, that you guys are using it, but so is Barack Obama, so is John Edwards, so is Hillary Clinton. And you should understand that Mellencamp is very liberal. And do you really think that it's pushing your agenda in the right direction? I mean, you're just really falling in line with all the other liberal candidates. Maybe you guys should rethink using the song. We didn't tell them not to use it. We just wrote a letter that said, you know, why don't you guys might want to rethink about using this song. And they quit using it.
When you write songs like Pink Houses or This Is Our Country or R.O.C.K. in the USA, do you think I'm going to sit down and write an anthem?
No, not really, because if you hear me play these songs, like you just remember, they're not anthems at all. They're folk songs.
That's true.
I mean, you know, like I just played the chorus of Pink Houses. That's not an anthem. That's a folk song. But see, that's what I was talking about. And all the songs that you named were music from the 80s that had to be, you know, dressed up in a certain way or they weren't going to be on the radio. If I, like, you know, I'm going to go out on tour and I'm going to play just me and acoustic guitar, and all of these songs take on a whole different feeling or meaning when you hear me playing by myself, because they're not wrapped up in the music of the time.
Mm-hmm.
They're just songs. I'll give you a good example. Hold on. Listen. I need a lover that won't drive me crazy. I need a lover that won't drive me mad. I need a lover that won't drive me crazy. I need a girl like one I ain't never had. It's a whole different song.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a whole different song than the song that you grew up hearing and you know, I grew up playing. but that's what the music of the time required. But don't get me wrong, I'm not complaining. I was very fortunate. I had a lot of hit records. And, you know, I'm 57 years old. I'm still out playing shows, and people still know my songs. And so, you know, I feel very fortunate about all that. So I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that, you know, trying to be an artist inside the music business has always been challenging for me.
John Mellencamp speaking to Terry Gross in March. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's interview with singer-songwriter John Mellencamp. He has a new live album titled Life, Death, Live, and Freedom, which features songs from his previous album, Life, Death, Love, and Freedom. And he's on tour this summer, sharing the stage with Bob Dylan and his band, and Willie Nelson. Mellencamp's hits from the 1980s include Jack and Diane, Hurts So Good, and Small Town. His song, This Is Our Country, was used for a series of Chevy ads, and at Barack Obama's inaugural celebration at the Lincoln Memorial, he performed his song, Pink Houses. John Mellencamp grew up in a small town in Indiana. When Terry spoke to him in March, she asked him about the first records he owned as a child.
The first record I ever bought was The Twist. With my own money, I bought that by Chubby Checker, and I was, like, maybe, you know, 7 or 6 years old. This girl that lived next door to us, her and I entered the Twist contest in the window of the dime store in Seymour, Indiana, and we won the Twist contest. But we didn't really have any Twist music, so I had to go buy Chubby Checker. But I grew up in a household where my dad is only 20 years older than me, so my dad had, you know, I had access to a lot of music, and my dad thought at the time, I think he was, you know, him and his buddy had bongo parties where they bongo. So, you know, I was exposed to Woody Guthrie, Odetta, you know, all kind of music through my father's record collection. So, and I had an older brother who was 4 years older than me, who also played guitar and was really a much better singer than me.
Could you maybe play an excerpt of a song that you feel is like in your DNA because you heard it and loved it when you were young? Either a song that you discovered on your own or a song from your father's collection that's just kind of in your blood?
Let me see. Come gather around people wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and soon you'll sink like a stone. Anyway, my brother had that, brought that record home in 1963, 1962, whatever year it came out, and it made a huge impression on me, that Bob Dylan fella.
Yeah, what impact did Dylan have on you when you were young?
Well, I mean, he was the ultimate songwriter. You know, I never even considered writing songs until I was much older, because I was a singer in a rock band. You know, I was in a bar. You remember, you know, the mid-70s. There were so many rock bars. You know, and I was one of those guys, you know, playing and singing. And there was no reason for me to write a song, because there were so many beautiful songs out. And you know, we would, in one hand, you know, I had Bob Dylan, and in the other hand, I had Iggy Pop. You know, when we would go from a Dylan song to a Stooges song all in one set. So, you know, there was no reason for me to write songs. So, but Bob Dylan was always the ultimate songwriter, and nobody could ever write a song as good as him, and nobody ever has written songs as good as him. And, you know, so, you know, what I thought it.
So what made you think about writing songs, not just singing them?
I got a record deal.
And you had to write because of that?
Yeah.
Really? So you hadn't written songs?
Oh, before? You know, I'd written songs, you know, to get girls to come over at the house or something. But other than that, you know, I was never really serious about songwriting until probably 80-something or another. I'd written
that.
Wait,
let me stop you. So when you'd write a song to get a girl to come over to the house,
yeah. Would
you stare into her eyes in a dreamy way as you played the song?
No, I never had to do that.
No?
I never had to do that. They just dropped everything. I don't think I was...
If you say so.
Well, I don't think I was the only one. That's my point, you know.
Okay.
I'm not saying they dropped everything for me. They just, you know, girls at that time, if you had a guitar, they liked you. And, you know, I wasn't the only one. I mean, you know, there was a long line of guys walking around my town with the guitar case.
So you moved from Indiana to New York to get close to the record industry.
That's not true.
No? Okay, go ahead.
No. I moved from Indiana to London.
Oh.
And I lived in London in 1977 and 78. And the only reason I moved to London that I had a record deal when I actually, here's what happened. It's a boring story. It's the same old story you've heard a million times. Anyway, I go to New York, and I wanted to take a look at the New York Art Student League, or I wanted to get a record deal. I didn't really care which. Is it going to be a painter or a songwriter? Since the Art Student League cost a lot of money, that was out because I had no money. And I went there, and it wasn't this simple, but I got a record deal pretty rapidly. And then it was, I made a couple records that were terrible. I was managed by the same guy that managed Bowie. And he tried to recreate me into an American David Bowie. It just didn't work, and him and I fought all the time. And that's where Johnny Cougar came from. And all
was that his idea?
Yeah, it was a terrible idea. I told him at the time it was a terrible idea. And, of course, he didn't like that. You know, he wasn't going to take that from snappy young brats such as myself. You know, he was the P.T. Barnum of the whole thing. He created David Bowie and reminded me of that all the time. But anyway, so I was with him for, you know, I made a couple records with him that were terrible, terrible, not worth listening, not worth looking at. And then I met a manager who was a shyster, and he said, you know, I can't get a record deal here in the United States for you, but if you come to London, I can get one in Europe. So we moved to London, and I lived in London for 2 years. And it was a great experience, and eye-opening for, you know, to move from Seymour, Indiana to London, England, and be living on you know, right in Chelsea, and the whole punk rock thing was just starting to explode, and there I was with an acoustic guitar.
Right. So it was really hard for you to get rid of the Cougar thing, wasn't it?
Oh, it's never going, it'll never leave. I still walk down the street and people will say, hey, John Cougar, you know, I hear it all the time, or John Cougar Mellencamp, I'll be introduced that way. But, you know, that's what it was, you know. I mean, that's what people, you know, knew me as at that time. And that's, you know, that's just the fate. That's, you know, that's the way God handed it out to me. And that's the cards I'm dealt. And so I deal with it.
Let me ask you about one of your early hits. And this is Jack and Diane from 1982. Well, there's a great line in that. Life goes on even after the thrill of living is gone.
See, there you go. Now we're talking about mortality again.
Yes, exactly. I know that occurred to me. that definitely occurred to me. Can you talk about how that line came to you?
Well, actually, they're putting together a box set of my songs, and the guy was just here yesterday who's producing it, was working on it, and this guy's leaving no stone unturned, so... He found a song that I had written before Jack and Diane called Jenny at 16 that had some of the same lines from Jack and Diane in it that I had abandoned that song, Jenny at 16, and turned it into Jack and Diane. And in the original writing of Jack and Diane, he discovered that Jack was black. So even back then, I was talking about interracial things, but for some reason or another, had abandoned that idea. So Jack and Diane was originally about an interracial couple, but I guess in 1981, I think maybe I decided maybe this is a little too pushing it too far, because, you know, this country's a pretty racist place, and so particularly in 81.
Can you do a few bars of Jack and Diane?
Yeah. Hold on. A little ditty about Jack and Diane, two man kids growing up in the heartland. Jackie gonna be a football star, Diane's debutante backseat of Jackie's car. Second on chili dog, outside taste freeze, Diane sitting on Jackie's lap, got his hands between the knees. Jackie said, hey, Diane, let's run off behind the shade of trees. Dribble off those Bobby Brooks, girl, let me do what I please. Oh, yeah,
Life goes on long after the thrill of living is gone. Oh yeah, say life goes on long after the thrill of living is gone. The walk on. That's it.
Did you know when you were writing that it would be really good to put in like details in the song, like the Tasty Freeze or the Chili Dogs? I mean, like story writers think of details like that. Songwriters don't always.
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't know. I can say this very crudely to you. A lot of those songs back then were not really written in my mind. They were written, you know, below my belt. They were songs that were only emotional. There was no, I wasn't sophisticated enough to think, oh, I should put a detail in here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was a guy in a band in a bar. And, you know, I saw what people did and partook in what people did in those bars. I was part of that scene in the Midwest. And it was a rough-ass crowd some nights, and some nights it wasn't, you know. So, that's where songs like Lonely All Night came from. Music was a sideline for me at that time. You know, all my songs are written below my belt. And as I got older, they kind of raised up to my head and became more of, you know, you should pay attention to what you're writing because people are actually listening.
John Mellencamp speaking with Terry Gross. His new CD is a live album of the songs he recorded on his previous album, which was titled Life, Death, Love, and Freedom. They'll talk more, and he'll sing more, after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with John Mellencamp, recorded last March.
I wanted to ask you something, and this gets back to what we were talking about early on about mortality. And this question might strike you as kind of odd and a real stretch, and maybe it is, but I know that you were born with a tumor on your spine.
I was born with spina bifida.
That's like an opening in your spine, isn't it?
Yes, that's what it is.
That's really dangerous.
Well, in 1951, it was deadly. In 1951, you know, they would operate on people with, you know, with pinking shears and screwdrivers. And, and you know, they were still giving people lobotomies in 1951. You know, so the medical world was pretty not developed, not like today. And I was born with spina bifida, and it used to be the practice to let the baby lay there for 2 or 3 weeks, and if the baby survived, then they would operate on the baby. Thank God for me that there was a young doctor named Dr. Heinberger at Riley's Children's Hospital in Indianapolis who said, we've got to stop this, letting these kids die and letting them lay there because they won't survive. So the minute we see it, let's operate on them. And that's what he did with me. And generally, if you are born with that disease, wherever they operate on you from, you're crippled from that point down. My hole in my spine was right below my ears. So I should have been crippled from the neck down.
Do you think, and this is the part that's like really the stretch, because you were born so vulnerable and that you had a condition that nearly killed you, that could have killed you, do you think that you have some like retention of that and that there's something like deep inside that has always been in touch with mortality and vulnerability because of that? I mean, and even if you weren't aware of it, like your parents would have been.
Well, my parents didn't even tell me until I was, until some kid at school said to me when I was about in sixth, seventh, fifth or sixth grade, I'm sure. I was sitting in class and some kid goes, man, what's that big scar across the back of your neck? And I said, what scar? I didn't know there was a scar on the back of my neck. Apparently my parents told my brothers not to say anything to me, and they never said anything to me. And so I remember going home and going, what's the scar on my neck? And then I got the whole nine yards. And at, you know, 9 or 10 years old, I didn't much care. No, at that time I didn't care because I figured, well, you know, I've been a normal kid thus far. I have no reason to believe that I won't be anything but a normal kid. And I played football, and I ran track, and played baseball, and, you know, I did everything everybody else did. But, you know, I don't see that scar on the back of my neck, but, you know, I've been married to Elaine for 17 years, and she said the first time she kissed me and she put her hand on the back of my neck, she thought, what the world is that?
Can I close by asking you to do a song that you did not write, that you really love, that's by somebody else?
Okay, I will play a song that I have played at every party.
Oh, great. Okay.
That this is my party song, you know, when they hand me a guitar and say, John, play something. Everybody's laughing at the Early Bird Cafe. I've been hidden there since yesterday, and I believe I've lost my way. Charlotte's there in Albany, and Billy's there in Suede. There's money in their pockets, all the dues are paid. And there's wine on every table, and there's food on every plate. Well, I hope I get there pretty soon, before it gets too late. Well, I ran on down the road a while to the other side of town. My clothes were getting wrinkled, and my socks were falling down. But I could not stop to pull them up in fear that I'd be late. So I kept on running down the road until I saw the gate of the Early Bird Cafe, glowing golden like the sun. Everybody kept on singing, "Can come on," and we just begun. Well, I ran right in and I sat right down and I ordered up some wine. My talk was fast and clever, and the women all were fine. Charlotte asked me where I'd been with jade and ivory eyes, and I told her I'd been hung up with some beggar in disguise. Well, she laughed like temple bells. She kissed me on the cheek and said, "You know, it's hard to be alive sometimes, but it's easy to be dead."
You know, I feel like I should know that song, and I don't. Who's, tell me something about the song.
It's an old folk song, and it was originally recorded by, might even been written by a band called Jerry Hahn Brotherhood, which was a band that I saw play probably in 1968, opening up for Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. And they played that song, and I went, wow. But that's my party song. I've been playing this since I've been playing that song since I was 17 years old.
To really cheer up the party.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful song.
It is. It is.
John Mellencamp speaking to Terry Gross in March. John Mellencamp's new live CD is called Life, Death, Live, and Freedom. This summer, he's on tour sharing the stage with Bob Dylan and his band and Willie Nelson. From his new live CD, here's the song about racial confrontation in a Louisiana town.
All white jury hides the executioner's face. See how we all need you. Everyone here will need to know their place. Let's keep this blackbird headed in the flu. Oh, hey, Gina. Oh, hey, Gina. Oh, hey, Gina. Take your nooses down. Up it comes, boys who cannot think straight, particularly those with paperback skin. Yes, sir, no, sir, we'll wipe that smile right off your face. We got a rules here, and you must fit in. Oh, hey, Gino.
Ever since it won the Golden Lion at the 1961 Venice Film Festival, the French film Last Year at Marienbad by Alain René has inspired wildly divergent passions, often in the same person. The British critic Jeff Andrew declared it, quote, either some sort of masterpiece or meaningless twaddle, unquote. The movie is now out in a new two-disc version from Criterion with a restored high-definition digital transfer. Our critic at large, John Powers, says it's like a monument from an earlier era.
It's been almost half a century since America entered the short-lived glory days of the art film. Movies that not only tackled serious themes, but did so with a strikingly modernist insistence on style. Such films felt new and exciting back then. And though it now sounds unbelievable, audiences actually left the theater arguing about whether they'd seen something revelatory or something merely pretentious. No movie was more controversial than Alain René's 1961 Last Year at Marienbad, which became so notorious that I'd seen it parodied before I actually ever saw the film at my college film society. I still remember how stoked I was to be able to see it, and frankly, how bored and baffled I was when I did. Here was art cinema with a vengeance. The guy who introduced the film called it great, and I left the theater asking my girlfriend, "Can something be great if it's not any good?" Yet the funny thing about Last Year at Marienbad is that it stayed with me over the decades, far more than many movies I'd thought better at the time. Still, this was never enough to get me to watch it again, until a few days ago. That's when I checked out the new DVD version from Criterion, whose ravishing black-and-white widescreen transfer captures the beauty of Sacha Vierney's images in a way that few viewers have ever seen. The story, if you can call it that, takes place at a resort whose chateau is filled with grand rooms, endless corridors, and enough Rococo decor to have Liberace screaming for mercy. Surrounded by socialites who stand around like zombies, a toothsome Italian man named X, played by Giorgio Albertazzi, pursues a glamorous French woman named Y. That's riveting Delphine Seyrig, hair swooped tight across her forehead and clad in a series of spectacular gowns designed by Coco Chanel. Over and over, X tells her that they'd had an affair the previous year, perhaps in the Czech spa town of Marienbad, and that she'd agreed to leave M, a faintly Draculean figure who's either her husband or her lover. Over and over, Y resists X's entreaties, insisting, truthfully or not, that she doesn't even remember having met him. And that's pretty much it. As Renee's camera glides through the chateau and its spectacular grounds, X and Y play out versions of the same scene so many times that we soon grasp that all the usual guideposts of a movie have been deliberately erased. The script, by avant-garde novelist Alain Robbe-Grillet, refuses to tell us whether what we're seeing is taking place in the past, the present, or the future, or whether it actually took place at all. Fantasy and reality, past and present, have been telescoped into an eternal now. Over the years, there have been countless theories of what this all might mean. Is the movie a parable of an era haunted by nuclear war? Is it about the repressed memory of a rape? Or could it all be just an intellectual game? Me, I think René is making a connection between two different kinds of wooing. Just as X tries to win over the reluctant Y, the movie itself is trying to seduce us into entering its imaginary world, which, like all movie worlds, is outside time. Half a century later, the world René wants us to enter remains as unsettling as quicksand and far more timeless than, say, Breathless or La Dolce Vita. He himself saw the film as an experiment, an exercise in high style. And what's striking is that this hypnotic work feels far more radical, more avant-garde, than anything I saw at Cannes this year, much less anything that will actually open in our theaters. It now seems incredible that such a movie could have been released commercially, let alone become an international touchstone, one that would inspire a zillion fashion shoots and perfume commercials, influencing everything from Stanley Kubrick's The Shining to music videos by Blur. Does this mean I now like the movie? I can't honestly say that I do, but liking it seems almost beside the point. Last Year at Marienbad is one of those primal experiences that's somehow just there, like the Grand Canyon or the Acropolis, or maybe Las Vegas. However you feel about it, this is one movie you never forget, even if you can't remember much of anything that happens in it.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue.